Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Jamuna Tira Vanachari. Jamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Punja Vihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Jaya Om Vishnu Pad Paramahansa Parivrajaka Charya Stotara Satasi Srimadisi Bhakti Vedanta Saman Prabhupada Ki Jai. ISKCON Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Jaya Vishnupad Paramahansa Parivrajakacharya Sotara Satsi Sima Bhakti Siddhant Sarasati Thakur Ki Jai. Nandakoti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. Namacharya Siddha Haridas Thakur Ki Jai. Prem Sikha Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Daita Gadadhar Sivasati Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Sri Sri Radha Krishna Gopinatha Shyamakunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhan Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai. Mayapur Dham Ki Jai. Jagannath Swami Ki Jai. Gangamayi Ki Jai. Jamunamayi Ki Jai. Tulsi Devi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Samaveto Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. All glories of the assembled devotees. All glories of the assembled devotees. All glories of the assembled devotees. Gaur Premanandi Hari Hari Bol.
So, Srila Prabhupada's presentation of Srimad Bhagavatam.
322.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Kshatta Maha Bhagavata Krishnasya Ekantikaha Suhrit Yas Tatyaja Agrajam Krishne Sapatyam Agavan Iti Kshatta Mahabhagavata Kshatta Mahabhagavata Krishnasya Ikantika Suhrit Krishnasya Ikantika Suhrit Yastatyajagrajam Krishne
Yastatya jagrajam krishne sapatyam aghavaniti sapatyam aghavaniti kshatta mahabhagavata krishnasyaikantikaksurit yastatya jagrajam krishne sapatyam aghavaniti. So, ladies, yastatya jagrajam krishne last chance. So, Srila Prabhupada's translation, Kshatta, of course, means Vidura, Mahabhagavata, great devotee of the Lord, Krishnasya, of Lord Krishna, Ekantika. Unalloyed devotee, Suhrit, intimate friend, Yaha, Hihu, Tatyaja, abandoned, Agrajam, his elder brother, King Dhritarashtra, Krishna, toward Krishna, Sa Apatyam. Along with his 100 sons, Agavan, offender, iti thus. Prabhupada's translation, Shonaka Rishi inquired about Vidura, who was a great devotee and friend of Lord Krishna, and who gave up the company of his elder brother because the latter, along with his sons, played tricks against the desires of the Lord. Prabhupada's purport. The incident referred to here is that Vidura left the protection of his elder brother Dhritarashtra, went traveling everywhere to sacred places, and met Maitreya at Haridwar. Shonaka Rishi here inquires about the topics of the conversation between Maitreya Rishi and Vidura. Vidura's qualification was that he was not only a friend of the Lord, but also a great devotee. When Krishna tried to stop the war and mitigate the misunderstanding between the cousin brothers, they refused to accept his counsel. Meaning the sons of Dhritarashtra. Therefore, Kshatta, or Vidura, was unsatisfied with them and left the palace. As a devotee, Vidura showed by example that anywhere that Krishna is not honored is a place unfit for human habitation. A devotee may be tolerant regarding his own interests, but he should not be tolerant when there is misbehavior toward the Lord or the Lord's devotee. Here the word Agavan is very significant, for it indicates that the Kauravas, Dhritarashtra's sons, lost the war because of being sinful in disobeying Krishna's instructions. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedan Shamini Tinamine Namaste Saraswate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishe Shunyavani Paschati Desha Dharine. Kind of disappeared there. So, Kshatta Mahabhagavata Krishnasya Ikantika Ksuhit Yastatya Jagrajam Krishne Sapatyam Bhagavan Iti. So, Kshatta, of course, is Vidura. Mahabhagavata, the great Bhagavata. The word Bhagavata is from the word Bhagavan. It means one who is always in relationship with Bhagavan, and so it comes to mean devotee, as we translate it. But interestingly, the word devotee comes from the Latin devoto, which literally means by a vow. In other words, one who lives by a vow. Like we have the English word votary, someone who takes a vow to something. So to be a devotee, at least in a grammatical sense, means to live by a vow. And that's why it's so important when we're initiated, we take a vow. And even those, of course, who aren't may not be initiated can also vow to serve Krishna. But it's actually that taking and keeping of a vow that literally makes one a devotee. Anyway, Chatta Mahabhagavata Krishnasya Ekantika Ksuhrit. So Vidura is here described as Krishna's Ekantika. The word ekantika comes from, of course, it's a combination of two words, or from two words, eka, which means one, and anta means end. It's actually related probably to the English word end, and ant. But anta means the end in the sense of a goal. We use the word also in English in that way. We say like he's not up to any good end. Or so end means a goal, the purpose of something. So someone whose only goal, whose only end is Krishna, is called ekantika. Ekanta or ekantika here. That's what the word means, literally. Prabhupada translates here as unalloyed devotee. And of course, you remember what the word alloy means. Alloy means a mixture like metal alloy where you mix two things together. Gold alloy, it's not pure gold. So here, ekantika, Krishnasya ekantika, means one whose only goal, whose only purpose is Krishna. Vidura is also described here as Suhrit. Prabhupada says in his purport that Vidura was not only a friend of the Lord, but also a great devotee. So, the word friend here is indicated by the word... Morning, Balaram. Also indicated by the word here, Suhrit. Suhrit, which Prabhupada translates intimate friend, literally means good heart. Hrit is heart, and Su is good. So, in other words, if you have a good heart towards someone, that's literally what the word means, Suhrit. Prabhupada often translates it well-wishing friend, or here intimate friend, literally good heart. So, Krishna Syaikantika Suhrit, yes, one who, Vidura, Tatyaja, rejected, Agrajam, literally the firstborn. Agra means first here, Jav, born. So, he rejected the firstborn. And within the context of Vedic culture, or any traditional culture, the whole principle of primogeniture, being the firstborn. Son, being the firstborn is very important. Often, in most traditional cultures, inheritance is preference in rights of inheritance is given to the firstborn. So normally, within traditional society, and also Vedic society, many things we call Vedic, they're also found all around the world. It's just natural. And sometimes, if you raise the question, why are so many principles which are Vedic culture found all around the world, and we tend to think because there's some type of a historical or prehistorical influence that can no longer be traced where people were influenced by what was going on in India, Prabhupada actually gave a different explanation. I don't mean to say there's no historical influence. Of course, there is some historical influence. But Prabhupada, for example, in talking about the Varnashram system, Chatur Varnya Mayastrishtam, Krishna says, I've created the four Varnas. It's a letter. Krishna, Prabhupada says that that you'll find these four varnas all over the world because they're natural, because they're created by God. I'm missing something there? In other words, Prabhupada doesn't say that because of some type of prehistorical, meaning you can't trace it historically, some kind of prehistorical influence, that therefore all around the world you find there is intellectual classes or teachers, warriors, merchants, and work and sudra class, merchants. Prabhupada rather says that you find these things because they're natural, because they're created by Krishna. So in the same way, it's said here that oh, wait, anyone that wants to do anything else right now, just do it. If you want to read something or talk to someone or move something or get up or sit down, this is like a free time right now. So everybody can do whatever they would like to do right now besides listening to the class. No? Okay. So we find here that it's specifically mentioned that Dhritarashtra gave up, Vidura rejected his older brother, which is considered to be a very heavy thing to do. And I'm pointing out that in other cultures all around the world, the older brother has importance. So does this mean that therefore, were it not for the influence of whatever was going on in India, that no one would have ever come to this conclusion? That older brothers or the eldest brother would never have been considered important in any culture around the world if it hadn't been for Indian influence or the influence of Vedic culture going on in India. What I'm suggesting is Prabhupada gives a different explanation, or at least a different possible explanation for cases like this, which is that it's natural. That's natural, and that Vedic culture is actually natural, and that therefore, so for example, Prabhupada says that all around the world you find this system where teachers are honored, more or less, even in India and even in other countries at different times in history, the social status of teachers and priests may, you know, wax or wane, it may go up or down, but in general you find around the world that priests or teachers tend to be honored in certain ways, that there are warriors, that there are, or governors, that there are merchants, and then there are workers, and so on. So, Prabhupada says that you find these things, albeit in a somewhat perverse form, or not exactly with a pure understanding, but you tend to find these things around the world, which means that you tend to find Vedic culture around the world. So, the extent to which we can discover Vedic culture around the world and, so to speak, revive it or activate it or point out to people that this is actually your traditional culture. Also, it seems to me that the easier it will be to really establish Vedic culture. To give an example, a very contemporary example, now the situation in Iraq, where America is seeking to assure the world that we come not as invaders or occupiers or a new type of colonialist, but we just want to get Iraq on its feet. We want to get the country on its feet, establish functional government, which is sane and not crazy, and then get out and let people have their... So in the same way, it seems to me that Prabhupada, if you listen to what Prabhupada said when he came to America, that just add Krishna... you simply have to add Krishna, and so on and so forth, that Prabhupada came not merely as a cultural colonialist In other words, not merely to change everything that goes on here, but to add Krishna, to get people to put Krishna in the center, and then to begin to live in a way which is Krishna conscious, according to the principles of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and so on. And so, in that way, to give that example, the more we can actually appreciate, the more we can make Krishna consciousness and Vedic culture natural for people, trying to engage them, trying to show them how they can add Krishna, how they can discover Krishna within everything. As Krishna says in the Gita, I'm within everything. So the more we can show people how they can discover Krishna within their lives, and that Krishna is actually the real purpose of everything they consider to be civilization and culture, whatever moral principles they have, whatever culture they have, the real purpose behind this, the real historical explanation behind this is Krishna. Just as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Vedais cha sarvair aham eva vedyo, by all the Vedas I am to be known. But of course the word Veda in Sanskrit doesn't simply mean a particular scripture written in Sanskrit. It means knowledge. It means knowledge. So what Krishna is saying is also, by all knowledge, I alone am to be known. By all knowledge. There's an incident where Prabhupada was, I think, in his room talking to some people, and some girl asked why Joan of Arc wasn't in the Bhagavatam, which was a really thoughtful question. Anyway, why wasn't Joan of Arc in the Bhagavatam? Of course, the answer is obvious, because when the Bhagavatam was written, the movie hadn't come out yet. Anyway, what Prabhupada replied was that, first of all, he said, if Joan of Arc is actually a devotee, actually serving God, then whatever book, whatever authentic book exists about her, that's also the Bhagavatam. He said, why don't you see that Bhagavatam? Why do you only see this Bhagavatam? So that's it. So if you look at Prabhupada's teachings, if you look carefully at the way Prabhupada presented Krishna consciousness, we are conditioned souls. We are conditioned souls, and so therefore, there's also the danger that our understanding of Prabhupada may be conditioned. I don't mean to say by that we've misunderstood everything, that everything is wrong, that we're not really even supposed to be worshiping Krishna. That's not my point. I think basically we've got it right. But in terms of nuances, in terms of subtle point, in terms of understanding Prabhupada's attitude, his approach, the way he was able to penetrate world society, I think we still have a lot to learn. It's not that, well, I've read Prabhupada's books and so I know Prabhupada's philosophy. In a sense, that's true. But I think in terms of, Prabhupada had a genius for presenting Krishna consciousness. He had a genius for presenting this movement. And I think it's something we definitely still need to study. It's something we still need to learn a lot more about. Because Prabhupada came to this country and got fantastic results. Our results are obviously somewhat less. That's to be expected. But still, Prabhupada didn't say to us, well, of course, you're going to get very small results compared to me, so don't worry about it because you're not pure devotees. Prabhupada actually asked us to represent him and to spread the movement. Prabhupada actually wanted the movement to spread far and wide, even after his physical pastimes. So I think Prabhupada, it's a living topic. It's not simply a philosophy that we learn and then we hear over and over again, sort of for inspirational purposes. We're hearing things we know, like you're not the body and so on. It's actually a living, Prabhupada's teachings are very much alive. Not only can we realize what Prabhupada is saying more and more, but we can learn much more about the life of Prabhupada and how he preached and what he did and what his real attitude was, and get past our own stereotypes. Another point is, here I want to bring out Yastityajagrajang Krishne, that Vidura significantly gave up the one person whom normally in Vedic culture you would never reject, your older brother. The firstborn. Why? Because sapatya magavaniti. Because the word iti here is like a quotation mark in Sanskrit. And it's almost like in those comic books, they have little thought bubbles So agavan iti, the word iti indicates the word agavan is inside one of those little thought bubbles where they have the little circles going up, as opposed to direct speech where it's just a line or an arrow. So this means that Vidura, this is what Vidura thought. Vidura gave him up thinking, quote unquote, agavan. He's sinful. The word aga, of course, is also found in the word agasura, which we all pronounce agasura. Agasura means the sin demon. The sin demon, aga, aga asura. And here's simply the word agavan, like bhagavan, one who has aga, one who has sin or has committed sin or an offense. there's something significant, since we're talking about really understanding things properly. If you look at the Mahabharata, the text, and if you look at the Bhagavatam, which tells many Mahabharata stories, in fact, the Bhagavatam gives the basic story of the Mahabharata in the first chapter, third chapter, chapters 9 and 10 and so on, and 11. They're somewhat, in some ways, they're slightly different. Not in the basic story. The basic story, of course, is the same, but the great Sripad Madhvacharya, the great Madhvacharya, to whom we are linked in Parampara, wrote a book on the Mahabharata called the Mahabharata Tatparya Nirnaya. In this book, he says that the Sanskrit text of the Mahabharata is corrupt. In fact, he says it's corrupt throughout. So, that's interesting. Madhvacharya says that the text is corrupt. It does, again, in the Bhagavatam, we have the basic story. We know there were five Pandavas. They were sons of Pandu. Their mother was Kunti. Their cousin was Krishna. We know that Pandu died and that they went back to Hastinapur. They were cheated by their cousins and stepfather or uncle. There was a battle of Kurukshetra. So all the basic story is as we understand it. We're not talking about changing that. However, to give an example of a detail, which is somewhat different in the two stories, in the Mahabharata, which Madhvacharya says is a text which has been corrupted, Dhritarashtra is sort of exonerated. He's shown much more to be sort of almost an innocent bystander. He didn't really know what was going on. However, in the Bhagavatam, we get a very different picture, especially in this third canto. Especially in this third canto, where here Vidura rejects Dhritarashtra because he says he's an offender against Krishna. He's an offender against Krishna. And similarly, in the beginning of the third canto, there's a very dramatic verse, very different from the Mahabharata, which says that in the beginning of the third canto, it's giving sort of a summary of what's gone on in the Mahabharata, I mean, at least in the life of the Pandavas and Vidura up to that point, why he renounced everything. It said that Dhritarashtra arranged for the Pandavas going to a house of lack, and then Dadaha, he burned the house. Now, the Mahabharata says that Dhritarashtra didn't really know what was going on, or his son, Duryodhana, kept nagging him, let's get rid of the Pandavas, just send them off to... Actually, in the Mahabharata, Duryodhana says to his father, Dhritarashtra, just get the Pandavas out of town and give me a chance to consolidate my political power. In other words, what Duryodhana actually asks his father, just get them out of here. Get them out of town so I can bribe and, do dirty politics with all the leading generals and ministers and kings and regional kings, and then they can come back after I've consolidated my power. But the Bhagavatam says that Dhritarashtra himself burned the house. Now, that doesn't mean that Dhritarashtra went there with a match or a torch or something. But in other words, he's directly, the blame is placed squarely on Dhritarashtra. You have this very powerful, simple, past tense verb, dadaha. He burned it. He burned the house. And so you can see how, I mean, it's not hard to understand that in Hindu society, where you don't criticize your father, you don't criticize your grandfather, that over time, Dhritarashtra's culpability may have been kind of erased. Anyway, that's But we have the Bhagavatam. Therefore, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said that all the conclusions are given in the Bhagavatam. But at least it's something to be aware of. There are historical issues, even regarding these texts, according to Madhvacharya. I mean, after all, what do you do with the Mahabharata when at the end everyone, including the Pandavas, has absolutely zero interest in going back to Godhead and everybody just wants to go back to Indraloka? And what do you do with that? And in fact, if you look at the Bhagavatam itself, if you look at the Bhagavatam itself, in the first canto, I think the chapter 5, where Narada comes to encourage his disciple Vyas, who's depressed, discouraged after compiling all these literatures. And Narada makes a very heavy statement. Very, very heavy. He says right there in the Bhagavatam, he says to Vyasadeva, Jugupsitam, this is abominable. Abominable. The word Jugupsitam means disgusting, horrible, abominable. Dharma krite nushasata, what has been taught for the sake of Dharma. For the sake of Dharma, you did this, but... And then he says, Subhavaraktasya mahan vyatikrama. This is a great transgression. It's a great crime. These are very strong words. These are very strong words, and he's speaking to someone who just composed the Mahabharata, by the way. And divided the Vedas. Because after all, Vyasadeva divided the Vedas. That's what the word Vyasa means. The word Vyasa means dividing. In that sense, editing or putting things in their place. That's what the word Vyasa means. So, there's no indication in the Bhagavatam or anywhere else that Vyasa put his own ideas into the Vedas. He didn't write the Vedas or... He simply divided them. Simply divided them. In fact, if you look at the names of the four Vedas, they're all categorical. Sama, where it would say Rig Veda, the word Rig in Sanskrit, or Rig, it means a hymn. So Rig Veda literally means the hymn book. And that's what it is. There's no direct teachings. It's just a book of hymns. So Rig Veda means the hymn book. And Sama means the science of the melodies, how to chant them. And so it's the song book or the music book, the melody book. And then you have the Yajurveda. Yajur means a sacrificial formula, how to do the sacrifices, what the purport is of the sacrifices, and how you do them. And so therefore, Yajurveda, sort of like the handbook for sacrifice. That's what it means. It means the handbook for sacrifices. It's a handbook. It's a manual. The sacrifice manual. Atharva Veda is kind of a little bit outside these three, and that's why in the Gita, Krishna calls the Vedas Trayi, the three. Evam Trayi, Dharma, Manu, Prapana, and so on, the ninth chapter. Because the Atharva Veda kind of has a little bit of Vedic voodoo in it. It like if you want to get rid of your enemies. It was considered to be a little not perfectly respectable in the way that the other three are, and so therefore the Vedas are often called the three. But Vyasadeva divided the Vedas. He didn't write them. He didn't compose them. He just divided them. What he actually composed, his original work, according to the Bhagavatam, was the Mahabharata. So when Narada comes along and says, disgusting, or abominable. This is a great transgression. I mean, I know that you did it for the sake of Dharma, boy, man, but this is really bad. And then you have Madhvacharya comes along and says that original text, which already was problematic, is corrupted through time. And if you read the Mahabharata, the unabridged one, because there's strong evidence it was originally an oral text. It was recited, and it's very big. So, I mean, did people actually memorize 100,000 verses and recite them perfectly all over India? Not according to Madhvacharya. So fortunately, we have the Bhagavatam, which Lord Chaitanya has certified as a pure text, and which even from the scholarly point of view is considered to be pretty much a pure text. It's seen as very different from other Sanskrit literature because it's, and the Gita. So our main text, the Gita, the Bhagavatam, from any point of view are considered to be reliable texts. And that's why Chaitanya Mahaprabhu emphasized the Bhagavatam. So in the Bhagavatam, like in this verse right here, we have blame being placed on Dhritarashtra in a way that's not in the Mahabharata text. Anyway, any questions on these points? Yes. Oh, yeah, that's very good. That's a very good point that you brought out. Because Karna, yeah. Well, Prabhupada just understood it. Prabhupada, as a pure devotee, just understood these things. Karna, again, just like Dhritarashtra, his role has to be kind of sanitized because he's the father, the elder. Similarly, Karna, as the real Agraja, Karna is the eldest brother, so he can't really be a villain because that would be disrespectful and un-Hindu. And so therefore, you have Karna. Karna can't even be defeated by his younger brother, so therefore what happens is he kind of implodes in the fight. He's just completely booby-trapped with curses, and you just kind of like watch him blow up before your eyes. Anyway, there's a lot to say about that, what really happened. And I mean, it's interesting how devotees, I've noticed, especially sentimental devotees, have this impression that, oh, poor Karna, he had a terrible childhood. He had nothing of the sort. He had a wonderful childhood. He had very loving parents. He loved his parents. They loved him. He was picked up out of the river as a little infant. So, I mean, he only knew them as his parents, and they were very loving, affectionate parents. What really happened, I think, is far more interesting because I think at the end of the Battle of Kurukshetra, there was a real fight between Karna and Arjuna. I think it was a real fight, the kind of thing you definitely, pay to view, pay per view. Whereas, I mean, imagine if you paid, hundreds of dollars to see this championship match that you've been waiting for years, like this, finally you're going to see these two guys go at it. You've been waiting for years to see this. And then they get into the ring, and one of them just kind of like, and suddenly some third party runs into the ring and bashes one of the fighters and breaks his arm, and then the fight's over. I mean, it's not even a fight. Personally, I think that Arjuna and Karna really fought. And Arjuna won. And it wasn't just a series of, I'll do this very quickly. Prabhupada said that we can engage in philosophical speculation, not mental speculation, which in Prabhupada's jargon, mental speculation means, like he said, rasoham apsu konteya, Krishna says, I'm the taste and water. If you wonder if Krishna is the taste and water, that's mental speculation. If you wonder how Krishna is the taste of water, he said, that's philosophical speculation. So now, in the Mahabharata, we find that in Vedic culture, there were two kinds of weapons, divya and manusha. In other words, celestial weapons and earthly weapons, human weapons. And that the rules of combat were that you fought your opponent according to, if your opponent has celestial weapons, you could use celestial weapons. If not, you would just use earthly weapons. And that rule was actually followed in the Battle of Kurukshetra. So now the weapons that Karna lost because he had lied on his college entrance application, he told... Basically, is what happened. He forged his transcripts, and he told Parashuram that he was a Brahmana when he wasn't. So therefore, he said, all the weapons I've given you will be lost to you. But the weapons he gave him were celestial weapons. I mean, just ordinary earthly weapons you could get by practice, as in the case of Ekalavya. So Karna, when Karna lost his celestial weapons, Arjuna also wouldn't have fired his. And even if we accept the Mahabharata version that Karna's chariot got bogged down, his chariot wheel got stuck, we also learn from the Mahabharata, if you read the unabridged version, that having your chariot disabled didn't mean necessarily you'd lose the fight. There are instances, for example, where Bhima, in the middle of a battle, would get off his chariot just because he kind of, you know, he liked to fight on the ground. He'd just go around with his club bashing everything. So therefore, if you study warfare, the history of warfare, having your chariot disabled did not necessarily mean you'd lose. So anyway, that's just one example. Karna had a happy childhood, and I think that, you know, there was a real fight with Arjuna, not necessarily to someone who was totally booby-trapped with curses. And accidentally killing a cow, that's sort of a, you know, in other words, accidentally shooting the wrong thing, killing the wrong thing in the hunt, and then getting cursed is what's called in literature a type scene. There was something which reoccurs. For example, Dasharath kills a Brahmin boy thinking him to be a deer. And is cursed. And is cursed to die. And then Pandu kills a Brahmin thinking him to be a deer. In this case, the Brahmin had the body of a deer and is cursed to die. Parikshit, of course, while hunting, just insults a Brahmin and is cursed to die. And similarly, so you have this thing applied to Karna. Well, Karna accidentally killed a cow, and so he's cursed to die. But, so anyway, Hare Krishna. So any other point? Yes? Well, what does it mean to add Krishna? I mean, this is, of course, a topic which we won't get into here. It's a long topic. Of course, if you want to become a formally initiated disciple, then you have to follow all the principles. You have to chant 16 rounds. You should have to study Prabhupada's books very carefully and so on and so forth. And hopefully you should take part in the Sankirtan movement. Now, the question is, right now, today, in ISKCON, what percentage of the people who consider themselves to be members of ISKCON, either congregational members or ashram residents, whatever, what percentage of the people who, at some level, consider themselves to be members of ISKCON, that this is my religion, what percentage of those people follow the four principles and chant 16 rounds a day? For example, in a large city like Los Angeles, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that consider themselves to be somehow affiliated with this temple, isn't it? Like on Sunday you'll see them, or if you have a big festival you'll see them. And they're people who really think, this is my religion, these are my deities, this is my temple. And I'm sure they consider themselves at some level to be part of ISKCON, and they are part of ISKCON. So even in LA or any city in the world, if you take all the people who at some level are connected to Prabhupada's movement, what percentage of them chant 16 rounds and follow the four principles? Therefore, the question should be raised that in our initial presentations, in our public presentations of the movement, should they be aimed at prospective initiates or the majority who will likely simply become members of our congregations? And then as people show greater interest, of course, they should be trained in the finer principles of bhakti yoga and so on. So stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Ami jamuno puline kadamba karane ki heni nu shakiyat. Ami jamuno puline kadamba karane. Hasri Hari Ashtashakti Parijana. আমার শ্যামা